this land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be.
Well, good evening and welcome to Yada Yada Radio. We're here with Kirk this evening. How are you, Captain Kirk?
I'm doing good, thank you. You're good?
Good, I'm doing just fine, except I did have a major calamity this week. I just completed a chapter about 15, 20 minutes before the show began, and it's so bad that my wife screamed at me for it and says, walked away as many of these chapters, I read sections of it to her before, while I'm it's current and I'm writing about it. And she says, don't you dare read any more of that to me, and stormed off twice.
Well.
Yeah. So either my writing qualities. Now, to be fair, because we're going to talk about God's animosity to the Jewish religion, what I did mm-hmm. is I found an article written by a rabbi. Rabbi Samson was published
yes.
in one of the two or three Jewish newspapers, that Israeli newspapers mm-hmm. that I read each day. They're actually my favorite newspapers, and the one of them Channel 7, I think, is how they go by in Israel. But one of them has a section that is called Religion. And in it, there was an article about rabbis being prophets. And
really?
I included it in the chapter because in Hosea, and I'm translating the book of Hosea now, Yahweh was condemning his people for pretending to be prophets when he has not spoken to them. And we haven't spoken to them really, if you're a Israelite from the Northern Kingdom, it's since Hosea's time, which is 800 mm-hmm. BCE. So it's been 2,800 years since Yahweh spoke through a Israelite. And about 2,500 years since he spoke through a Yehuda. So he even said in Hosea, this is going to be a really long intermission where I'm just not going to talk to you anymore. It's no use. And so with God condemning Judaism for rabbis claiming to be prophets, I hear this little voice always in the back of my head says, wait a minute, that's not fair for you to condemn the rabbis for claiming to be prophets, because rabbis don't claim to be prophets, or do they?
Well, I read the article you sent, so yeah.
yes, it was so kind of Rabbi Samson to come to the rescue.
Clear
here.
Up this misunderstanding.
Yes, so he was really, really a busy boy, citing all manner of Jewish religious texts, particularly the Babylonian Talmud, cite the many examples of rabbis being prophets. Of course, he never once revealed any one of their prophecies, because that wouldn't
that's
be
good. Safe.
He said no. that the message came via a Magid, and that's not good either, because a Magid is an itinerant Jewish minstrel, if you will. It's a person who strolls from place to place, singing a message out of Jewish folklore to Jewish gatherings. That was how they received their divine revelation. And the purpose of the article was to state that it's only in Eretz, the land of Israel, that you get pure and accurate prophecy, and that any claim to prophecy outside of Israel, even to the rabbis, has to be questioned and is filled with dross. one rabbi even says there are no prophets outside of the land of Israel. So the first thing that came to my mind is, who is the greatest
Daniel?
Of the prophets according to Yahweh?
Oh, well, Moshe, of course.
Oh, yeah. Moshe. Yeah. Was Moshe, did he ever step foot in the Eretz Yisrael?
Not one time.
Well, God gave him a flying carpet ride at the end of his career over Israel.
That don't count.
But that don't count.
Not,
he was never in the land. So the greatest of the prophets belies the conclusion. And then, of course, there's Daniel in Babylon. But I just thought it was particularly clever to point out that the Babylonian Talmud is the foundation of Rabbinic Judaism. And where do you suppose the Babylonian Talmud was written? Three guesses.
Babylon.
Okay, Babylon. These guys are just so utterly clueless. So I was reading this thing to her, and
the Torah, though. So to be all fair, they never
read the Torah. What Yahweh was complaining about in this particular passage was that his people plaster over and whitewash his message. And when you read what they write, it is a plastering over and whitewashing of Yahweh's testimony. They will take out of 20 citations, all of which are diligently ascribed to a rabbi who is named, and always the rabbi is glorified. Oh, his majesty, the wonderful, the enlightening, the ever-blessed rabbi scumbag. Of course, they never once say a kind word about Yahweh. They won't even mention his name. But they will, they for credibility's sake, out of the probably 50 citations in this article. There was one with a Torah address. Now, they misquoted it, and they misapplied it, but there was one there. Without that, it's kind of like the Quran. What would the Quran and New Testament be if they didn't try to usurp the credibility of Yahweh's testimony? So I come to you with a heavy heart. My last chapter has been rejected even by my wife. So
closest friend. Thanks, guys.
I guess what I should have done is, rather than include this rabbi's entire protestation affirming that rabbis claim to be prophets, that perhaps what I should have done was just have excerpts from his article. But gosh, when you read it, and I'll share it. You know, it's now only chapter 3 of volume 8, and so we're a long way from publishing this particular volume. But we'll get to it, you may have the same complaint. You may go running and screaming, but I didn't know what part to cut out, because it was like Yahweh had heard what these nincompoops had said and decided that, I think I'll expose and condemn them using their own words. This time last week, we were on my favorite prophet. I guess we all have favorites, right? Moshe was clearly, Dode was Yahweh's favorite prophet. Doe's my favorite person in the overall testimony, and Doe's clearly one of the three greatest prophets. And Moshe, from Yahweh's perspective, was the greatest prophet, but not so much because of the prophecy he revealed, but because of his overall role as the liberator of God's people. And God specifies it that way. But I'm not certain that God would concur with this, but my personal favorite prophet is Yahshua. I enjoy his vocabulary. I enjoy his writing style. I enjoy his passion. I think the sweeping insights that he reveals are extraordinary. And we are kindred spirits in a sense, in that Yahshua goes out of his way to explain the role that we would play in future events when it came to making his prophecy better understood by his people. So it is in Yahshua, and we are coming near the end of the eighth chapter. And as we've said, the reason we are covering this chapter in a volume called Shana, which is posted online at yadaya.com, which means to knowyah.com. It is free there on the bookshelf. You'll find it is volume 7 of the Yadaya series. It is the, I think, the 22nd book that we put on the shelf there. It's also available in print at Amazon Books. But we're covering this because the intent is to provide the proper perspective to understand what I think is the single most misapplied and misunderstood prophecy in the entirety of Yahweh's revelation. Not saying a lot, considering what Twistians have done to misapply them and take everything Yahweh has said of Dode and apply it to their misnomer, Jesus. But nonetheless, I think this is the most abused statement. And it is in Yahshua 9, 6, and 7. Most know it because of the opening line, unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. And then it speaks of some rather extraordinary descriptors of what this individual will bring to us. And it is my contention, and I am absolutely certain of this, and I don't think it is even possible to read the text and to come to any other conclusion, that the person being discussed is singular. And it ain't Jesus. It's done. But, you know, when they say, what's your first clue, Sherlock? Well, my first clue was that there's only one name mentioned in the prophecy.
That happens to be.
And that happens to be Dode. So I guess you don't have to be the smartest guy in the
room.
No,
even I can figure that out.
But I have to tell you, okay, so it's obvious. And we're going into all of this in the eighth chapter because context makes it all the more obvious. So why have Christians for 2,000 years falsely claimed this prophecy on behalf of their misnomer, Jesus Christ?
That's
a reasonable question. Yeah. And since... Yeah. It obviously speaks of Dode, and the superlatives are extraordinary. Why aren't Jews celebrating the life and lyrics of Dode David? Those are questions that deserve an answer, and I'm not aware of one. And when, this is 8:19 now from Yahshua, it means Yahweh liberates, delivers, protects, and saves from a combination of Yasha and Yah. And when, Wahki, so to the contrary, rather instead, they say to you, so this is the religious establishment speaking to Israelites, you should consult with Darish. You should choose to seek previously unknown information, expecting answers, resort to, petition, and ponder. Seriously consider revelations. Call imperative. Call is the voice of literal interpretations within a relationship. So these morons are serious about this. And in mm-hmm. The imperative is one of three volitional voices in Hebrew. The imperative expresses choice in the second person. So you should consult, you should choose, it should be your desire. So they're speaking to the desires of those obviously easily beguiled. You should consult with the mediums who speak for those who lived in the past. It's La'ob. Those who claim to communicate with the enlightened sages who have passed away, or the ghosts of the dead, a conjunction of Ab, fathers, and or light. So fathers of light, enlightened fathers.
Light. No.
Enlightened fathers. Now, that's a really interesting term because if you have skirted the diatribe of rabbinic Judaism, you'll recognize that they cite deceased rabbis 100-1 over Yahweh. Well, they never cite Yahweh
yes.
by name.
100-0.
But it's yeah. but it's a in terms of yeah. name citations, it's
yes.
it's millions upon millions to zero. But even if you forget for a moment
God.
That they never
mm-hmm.
used Yahweh's name, then it is it's typically 100-1 of citations of dead rabbis. There, I don't think there has ever been a religion that has paid greater homage to supposed sages of the past. They have shown a reverence for these men. They venerate these men. These men and their words mean vastly more to a religious Jew than does God or his testimony. And so this is speaking directly of Judaism. Now, I recognize that there was ancestor worship in,
mm-hmm.
in Imperial Japan.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't turning the words of their ancestors into scripture, creating a religion out of the scribbles and sayings of their deceased, which is exactly what Judaism is. So, and when they say to you, you should choose to consult with the mediums who speak for those who lived in the past and the spiritualists. This is Ha Yadaone, those claiming to possess spiritual insights such as Kabbalah, revealing troublesome knowledge gleaned from the spiritual world, providing invalid and antagonizing information from Yada to know and claim familiarity, and Oni to vex and grieve. So this is being familiar with really agonizing and vexing information.
Mm-hmm.
Who mediate and mutter unfounded sentiments, who ruminate over highly selective information to express their willful and imaginative opinions. This is Haga. This is saying that Judaism is a conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
And it is. It's a conspiracy to lead
yes.
the people away from God. And who twitter toxic music. Thank you, God. who chirp like birds.
He did that
and
on purpose,
mutter.
Right?
I mean, yeah, my guess is he did. But
yeah.
I don't think he
yeah.
has it out for Elon Musk. I don't think he really knows Elon
no,
Musk.
No. I'm
but
not talking about
nonetheless.
That's a show-off thing.
They just a little showing off here. If you've God, you might as well flaunt it.
yeah.
Instead, God says, instead, shouldn't the people, ha, lo, am, as a rhetorical question, would it not be
mm-hmm.
better for the family to consult with their God through the living, not the dead. So God's saying, hey, they're dead.
I'm not.
Why do you care what they say?
Yeah.
Now, there is an exception to reading the words of somebody who is dearly departed. That is if those words are proven to have been inspired by Yahweh, which you're reading is the voice of the living. You're reading the voice of the living God as conveyed through his prophets. But since these rabbis cannot prove inspiration, in fact, they prove that they were not inspired, it's simply the words of dead men. If you want to join them, believe them. But shouldn't the people consult with their God through the living instead of the dead? Now, the other inference here, and you know this might be a stretch, but since it comes up so often in Yeshaya, and just three chapters hence, the entire chapter is on this particular subject. Yeshaya is writing to a time in his future, our present and past. And what he's saying is that rabbinic Judaism has become nothing but an echo chamber of the rhetoric of deceased rabbis whom they venerate. And so God inspired Yeshaya to tell those Yehudim, Jews, who wish to reconcile their relationship with him, come to know him and engage in the covenant, that it would be a lot better to learn what God has to say through a person who is still living. Now, there aren't a lot of people writing to Jews about Yahweh that you could listen to on this day apart from what we're doing. Now, with the answer to this question, it was a rhetorical question, so obvious. Why do just one in a million consult with God through the living? Why do billions listen instead to dead men like Paul, who can't prove any prophetic inspiration, can't prove an inspiration for any word he wrote? In fact, he proves that he was not inspired. Same is true with Akiba. Same is true with Maimonides. Same is true with Muhammad. Every Christian saint, the sages among the rabbinic Talmudists, and successful suicide bombers share more than death common. Now, you should know that Al, translated as not at the conclusion of the sentence and written as Aleph Lamed, can be translated as either El or all. And as a noun, El is Almighty God. As a preposition, El is translated to or toward, by, among, or for. But all is also a term that is used to negate a verb. And there's a number of these in Hebrew. The most common is lo. And so by using all, in this particular case, the likely intent is that God is trying to negate what follows. So, if it is negating here, it would be negating ha-mut. So it seemed logical to select the definition which best fits the context of the discussion. Now, there were several words that I found amusing in Yahweh's declaration. A yada oni, a spiritualist, is yada, familiar with oni, as we mentioned, vexing grief and agony. That's the person I would run down the street and pay big bucks to listen to. How about you? just speculating here, but not much benefit in consulting with somebody who's going to tell you all the wonderful ways you can afflict yourself. Haga, which was translated as who mediate and mutter unfounded sentiments, speaks of ruminating over highly selective information to devise a plot and express a woefully imaginative opinion. This, of course, is the essence of conspiracy theories. Isolated information is removed from the context of an event, while all non-corroborating information is discarded. Then, while the conspiratorialist ruminates on their highly selective opinions, they mix in a plethora of bizarre theories. To their credit, they at least know that we are ruled by reptilian overlords on a flat earth with chemtrails. And political actors conducting mass murders. Yes, and designing vaccines that are really satanic plagues designed to attract the good little boys and girls.
Yes.
And third, as it relates to this passage, 2,700 years ago, as we shared a moment ago, Twitter was invented, knowing that social media would be the primary conduit of the crazies. Yeshaya wrote that they would Safa use Twitter to tweet their debilitating venom.
Yeah.
Social media has become the neurotoxin for this comatose generation. Now, that doesn't mean that everything on social media is a neurotoxin. That would be unfair.
No, but it's a tool for those who want
to. There's at least 0.1% of it that has some merit. You know, most of it now is voyeurism. My life is so boring. I need to spy on somebody else's pretense of a life to feel like I actually have a life. And, of course, the person is presenting the pretense of their life who wants you to know that they had green eggs and ham for lunch is projecting an entirely false narrative of their life, which is then being viewed voyeuristically by the person that has no life at all, which is worse than the person that has a magic
life. Finds
this
interesting, yeah.
So it's really, if you find that interesting, you know, go for it.
Go for it.
Not particularly recommending it. According to the Torah, this is now continuation. This is Yeshaya Isaiah 8:20. According to the Torah, which means source of teaching, guidance, instruction, and direction, and according to the written testimony, which presents correct and corroborating information regarding restoration, Ta'uda, the authorized documentation regarding the confirmation of the relationship agreement pertaining to an inheritance. That is a compound of Torah, source of guidance, instruction, direction, and teaching, and Ud, to repeatedly testify about restoration and to continually bear an affirming witness. We don't see Ta'uda very often. I did count how many times it's used in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, but I do know I've been doing this for 21 years, and this may be the only time that I translated it.
It was new to me. I did it as well.
Yeah, it's a wonderful word, though. So we have here, according to the Torah, source of teaching, guidance, direction, and direction, and according to the written testimony, which presents correct and corroborating information regarding restoration, Ta'uda, they do not speak in a manner consistent with this specific message and the way that it is worded, then as a result, they lack discernment and are without enlightenment in their approach to Shakar. Wow. All right. So one of the things that caused questioning Paul, which was first written at about 600 pages. The next rewrite was 800 pages, then 900 pages, and then 1,200 pages, and now it's four volumes. And I think the four volumes are like 2,500 pages. The reason it grew so long is really straightforward. Paul does not speak in a manner that is either consistent with the Torah, consistent with the written testimony, which presents the correct and corroborating information regarding restoration, and he does not speak in a manner that is consistent with how God's word is worded. And so it's hard to say, okay, I know I have presented 1,000 nails that I have hammered into his coffin where he has contradicted Yahweh. But this next one is also relevant. And where do you stop? But that's also the reason why my wife walked out on me. I'm sorry to say that my wife did walk out on me three times yesterday. Why I didn't go back and remove Rabbi Samson's great and inspired oratory is because every paragraph was filled with confessions. So the Quran, you know, I've written Prophet of Doom. It's a 1,000-page book that takes the chronologically recorded hadith from Muhammad and his companions and uses them to reorder the Quran and set it chronologically into the context of Muhammad's life. I don't know how you shorten the book when virtually everything he says is inconsistent with other things that he's said and wholly inconsistent with the Torah when he claims that it confirms the Torah. So this is the nature of those three religions. And it is also the nature of the minor religions as well. But of the three so-called Abrahamic religions, of course, Abraham did not have a religion. He had a relationship. They all do this very thing. Their testimony is inconsistent with the Word of God. And when that is the case, then the individual is without enlightenment, and they are speaking of Shakar.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Shakar is not somebody you want to have an up-close and personal relationship with. Shakar is the adversary's last name. You know, in Hebrew, it is Yosha ben Nun. So it's Yosha, son of Nun. And Satan's name is Hillel ben Shakar. Shakar speaks of the rising and setting sun. It's this time where there is very little light. Things are gloomy, the shadows are elongated. Things are even miscolored sometimes by the hue. And it speaks of the sun, which is the primary ruse of pagan gods, including the Christian god. Mm-hmm. You know, they wear the sundis kalos. They use the cross, which is a sun god symbol. They have the church steeples, which is like an obelisk designed to catch the first and the last rays of Shakar at the end of the day. Even Christmas and Easter, those are sun god-related holidays where the sun crosses the constellation of Taurus the bull at the vernal equinox and is said to have impregnated the earth such that 9 months later the son of the sun is born, which would be, of course, Christmas Day. So this is not a good thing. You do not want to be approaching, you know, it's one thing to be called ignorant by God, unenlightened, but it's far worse to be called satanic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this reference is all about. The 14th chapter of Yeshayah. which is presented in the Babel Confusion chapter of Volume 4 of Observations. Even just reading that, that seems the time that I wrote that and edited it now seems like a lifetime ago. But nonetheless, it is there in the Babel Confusion chapter of Volume 4 of Observations. We learn that Satan's name is Hillel ben Shakar, brightly shining sun of darkness. Hillel ben Shakar depicts the adversary as the flashy and boastful child of the East. The devil is, east of Israel, of course, is Babylon. The devil is comprised of contrasts, hypocrisy, and contradictions, as light and darkness, enlightenment and obscurity. Hasatan is an ostentatious show-off, a spiritual, energy-based being predisposed to mislead and to make others appear foolish as they descend into the darkness and gloom of a black hole. Shakar, Satan, is also known to us by the Canaanite and Phoenician religions. We find him, along with Baal, the Lord, throughout the Tel Rosh Shamar text, where Shakar is the name of the Canaanite and Phoenician god, of course, the rising sun. Imperial Japan would have loved him. The mythology of Shakar refers to the dawn and its dim light emerging out of the darkness. So did you study a few of these words, Kirk? Because this is an interesting text, and particularly those two words.
Yeah, no matter what you find, they're all kind of negative on this passage, other than the first opening ones about the Torah remarks. But Shakar is, light coming out of darkness. It's the name of Hasatan. I mean, there's nowhere you can go where you won't verify what you just said. Allah can only temporarily lighten the path, ultimately to darkness, Sheol. So I thought that interesting commentary. And then and even the words were blocked off from the observant man. If you look at the pictographs, you've got the words, and then you have a chet in the middle, and then you have a roach at the end. So,
You know what's interesting, Kirk, is that Yahweh is never presented as a light and darkness.
No.
Yahweh's light is so brilliant, it eliminates the darkness.
Right.
Yahweh will personally avoid entering a dark place where people are religious or political. The ultimate dark place is a black hole. Black would be your first clue. Hole would be your second.
Yes.
And so Yahweh light never emerges from darkness, but instead eliminates darkness.
Yeah. Well, you said a long time ago.
Yeah, go ahead.
You said a long time ago, when the light comes on, when you turn on the light, where does the darkness go? Well, it doesn't exist anymore. When his light is in you, he can see no darkness. It just isn't there.
Right.
But I thought it interesting when he returns.
Not actually, he can't see any darkness. There is no darkness.
Well, it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. Yeah. Yes, I should have said that. But
better than
when he returns
is to have nothing even
he's
to be forgiven
purpose.
For.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So it's what a plan.
Yeah, it's a really great term. Shakar, in terms of describing what Satan is all about, this dim light, this light out of the darkness, and Shakar's affinity with the sun, which was the chief deity of almost every religion. And when you look at particularly at the Roman Catholic Church, you'll find sun god edifices and references everywhere. And the halo disc, and even they wear the little round beanie cap that was so prevalent among the Greeks that does the kippah or yarmulke worn by religious Jews. Again, it's a sun god halo or disc. It's just sad that they would do it. And many of them will even put the Star of David on it. Now, as we know, David did not have a star, but
the
sun is a star. And what God is saying here is that when you are using solar and stellar imagery to convey your affinity for or reverence for a being, then the being you are worshiping is Satan.
It's the law. No.
So every time you see the Star of David on a religious text or religious image, you need to keep in mind that it is satanic. According to God, it's very much like all of the Christian imagery. They're satanic. Now, in Islam, Allah's a little wimpy. He went for a second fiddle.
Went for the moon.
And the bride of the sun is the moon. The moon god was called Sin, which just seems like an appropriate name for the Islamic god.
This is too good.
Nonetheless, it's true. They even have verses in the Quran where the moon and the sun are engaged in a race. It says that the moon was once a sun, but it was effaced and ceased being one by being humiliated. I guess it lost the race too many times. I think one time it actually fell out of its chariot, which would explain then what happens and make it quite not quite as stupid. Bad things happen when you fall out of your chariot.
Chariot.
It's one of the things I learned by studying the Quran is that and of course the creation account where we learned that Adam
blood cloud or something?
Colors because Allah created humankind after different colors of muddy and stinking slime. And of course it is nice when you read the Quran, if you were wondering where the sun goes to bed at night, it is in a murky spring. And should you wonder if anybody's ever been to the murky spring, yes, there's an answer for that too. Alexander the Great went there. And should you wonder if Alexander the Great was the first Muslim, yes, the answer is he was a Muslim. And he went to preach to the extraterrestrials. Yes, indeed, there are extraterrestrials. I don't know if they're reptilians. But Alexander the Great went there, according to the Quran, and preached to the extraterrestrials that live in and or around, I don't know if they're aquatic creatures or not, the muddy spring where the sun goes to bed at night. So there are some
1.5
insights.
Billion people like this.
Yeah, yeah. There are some insights worth wearing a tent over your head on behalf of. Then they will pass through it, stubborn and stiff-necked, strong-willed and perplexed, often starving and famished. And it will come to pass when they are malnourished and weakened, they will become antagonized and provoked to anger, struggling with their change in status. Their status will diminish, and they will be treated with contempt as a result of their propensity to slander and insult the reputation of their king and of their God, turning away while being unfaithful in the relationship. Now, there's really an interesting tidbit here where they will slander and insult the reputation of their king. Yahweh said some positive things about Solomon when he was a young and bright boy, but not much good about him later in life.
No.
There's a couple of moments where Hezekiah was a pretty righteous dude, but it didn't end well for him. There were three or four kings and the long list of kings who were right when it comes to God. But the overwhelming majority of them were horrible human beings. So God's not, in fact, even when the people said they wanted a king, It was said they want a king because they're rejecting me. And by choosing a king, these are the 12 things that are going to happen to them that are going to make their lives miserable. And, you know, as he then delineates them. We get the fire hose approach to God does not want us honoring kings, mm-hmm. with one exception. That same guy again.
Yes.
And so you have this statement in Yeshaya 8:21, preceding that glorious prophecy in 9, 6, and 7, and it's talking about they're being humiliated, they're being degraded because they had a propensity to insult the reputation of their king and their God, turning away while being unfaithful in the relationship. Well, he's speaking of the one king that was so magnificent in his leadership that Yahweh is not only bringing him back to protect his people, lead his people, counsel his people upon his return, but he's giving him sovereign rule over the entire universe for all time. So from the very beginning, those who have chosen to call themselves rabbis, great, what rabbi means. It does not mean teacher. It's from Rab. It means to be exceedingly great, not that they are, have shown a deplorable lack of humility. And it is this unwarranted air of superiority that has turned so many people against Jews. It is rabbis who have devastated God's people. If there had been no rabbis, there would have been no Christianity. Paul was a failed rabbi. If there had been no rabbis, there would have been no Islam. Muhammad ran out of Hanif poems to plagiarize and steal, and most of the Quran is stories that were recited to him from the Babylonian Talmud by rabbis, which he then twisted to serve his interests. And as it would transpire with rabbis condemning everyone, including the Jews who don't agree with their religious interpretation, rabbis became kind of their own personal reflection of what people then saw in the ethnicity as a whole. They came to symbolize the worst of Jews. They are greedy. Mm-hmm. They're the highest paid clerics in the world. They demand respect when they are amongst the least respectful people in the world. The propensity for child abuse, the propensity for rape and sexual assault is higher with rabbis than it is with Roman Catholic priests. The propensity of the religious to cover over the egregious behavior of rabbis is far greater than it is in the Roman Catholic Church to cover over the sins of the priests. If it were not for rabbis, it is likely that Jews and Yahweh, Yehudim and Yahweh, would have reconciled their relationship long ago. But because of the rabbis, they have never been further apart. With their ridiculously religious, money-grubbing kosher laws, they have weakened and malnourished the people, consistent with this statement. And in the process of elevating their words and edict over God's, they have antagonized and provoked the Almighty. Now, mind you, there is very, very little and the kosher laws that has anything to do with God's testimony. In typical religious fashion, they took two or three statements that God made where, you know, eating the flesh of swine is a bad idea.
Yes.
And they, you know, he talks about bottom fishing or bottom dwelling fish without scales, like catfish. That's probably a bad idea.
Not a good idea.
You know, and then he talks about crustaceans, the scavengers of the ocean, things like crabs and shrimps and the filter fish, and saying, that's a bad idea too. And it's true that until very recently, probably the last 50 years, most of those things would get you killed. They were the most prone to carrying disease, and God's instructions were wise. This is not healthy for you to eat. Later, of course, in the body, God says, you know, eat whatever you want. You know, he's all about freedom. Eat whatever you want.
Indeed.
Just do it thoughtfully.
Be mindful.
Yeah, be mindful of what you eat. In other words, I gave you some instructions that are helpful and healthful. You may want to pay attention to them. But God did not have any rules. And, you know, this whole nonsense of you can't drink wine unless it's approved by the rabbis. Supervised by the rabbi. God said no such thing. You can't drink milk unless a rabbi was there to watch you. They didn't milk the cow. Of course, that would be real work. Watch the cow being milked and get paid for it, and then watch it be processed. You can't drink that either. There's no edict against milk.
No.
There's no suggestion that milk has to be supervised. And then they go one step further. They said that you can't have, well, they go about a mile further, you can't eat milk and dairy at the same time. You can't even wash the plates in the same sink. Can't have it on the same plate. Can't wash the plates in the same sink. Can't use the same utensils. Have to eat one many hours after the other. Why? Well, you'd have to ask them. They claim it's because God said don't boil a kid in its mother's milk. Well, God's saying that isn't a healthy way to prepare the meat. Plus, as a metaphor, it's really disgusting. You know, the whole idea that, you know, eat a mature goat or lamb. Don't eat a baby. You know, this whole veal thing is pretty sadistic. And second, milk is the means of providing, is to nurture. Milk ought not be used as a way to boil a baby goat. So there's symbolic issues here. There's health issues here. There's squandering something that's nurturing here. And there's the whole idea that we ought not take the life of a baby. We ought not squander the nurturing nature of a mother, or the way that she would feed her child. All of those things are essential for us to know. But where they got from that is can't have them in the same meal, can't have them on the same plate, can't even at the same time, can't even wash them in the same sink. Talk about stupid.
No.
And religious Jews, they just lapped that shit up like it was, you know, golden apples fallen from heaven. And it just isn't. As a matter of fact, one of the stories where Abraham is entertaining Yahweh, Yahweh stopped by, they're going to have a little chat, and Sarah runs into the tent and feeds them a Jewish hamburger. He prepares some meat and a little cheese and serves them up together. Yeah, it's a Jewish cheeseburger.
Yeah, that's a taboo, huh?
I don't think God has the same view. So it's just this overall sense of making up stupid rules and trying to justify them to control people's lives, debilitate them, keep them so tied up in their underwear that they can't see far enough to actually read or care about what Yahweh has to say. So the money grubbers will find every possible way to control and fleece the people. They elevate their words and edicts above God's. They have antagonized and provoked the Almighty to the point that he will rid the world of them upon his return. By having insulted and slandered Yahweh, they have been unfaithful, creating an Adonai in their own image.
Mm-hmm.
The Molech, whose reputation has been upended by the religious, is Dod, the man Yahweh selected to be king. They do not recognize him as the Son of God. They don't speak of him as the Messiah. They don't understand that he is the one who is returning.
Mm-hmm.
And this, from a father's perspective, is insulting. This is the consequence of being misled. It is why Yahweh despises religion. This is Yeshayah, Isaiah 8:22. Unto the land they will look, but behold, they will see disfavor. They will see darkness with discouraging oppression. And to a place devoid of light, they will be driven and stray. Boy, to hear these rabbis write of Eretz Yisrael as if it were their own little fiefdom, the place where the Majid's inspirations were pure and without dross. So God is saying, yeah, they're going to look
in
the land,
space.
But what's actually going to be there is disfavor, anguishing trouble, distress, unfavorable circumstances, and darkness. They will find discouraging oppression. Boy, if the insights in Israel were so good, why, with the emergence of the rabbis, did everything turn so bad? It had been rough for Israel as a whole under the Assyrians, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Under the Babylonians, even the Yehudim were hauled away, but they got to come back. And then during the assaults by the Greeks had their influence, but they were not oppressive overseers. Romans initially invaded Israel. They sent the legions to Israel because of two Jews that were engaged in infighting as to who would be king and who would be chief priest. And it wasn't good enough for one to be king, the other one to be chief priest, because the job of chief priest was a lot more lucrative.
Mm-hmm.
But with the birth of rabbinic Judaism being late 1st, early 2nd century CE, everything changed. So if the rabbis are supposed to receive really, really super special divine revelation and prophecy in Eretz Yisrael, then why did Akiba recognize a false Messiah? Why did that lead to the Roman invasion and the diaspora, to Jews being hauled into Europe as slaves? Why did that start 2,000 years of hell for God's people? If the father of rabbinic Judaism, Rabbi Akiba, had such a brilliant and unfettered access to the truth, to prophetic revelation, why did he get everything wrong? And why do Jews venerate him when he brought more hell on God's people than anyone who's ever lived? It's worth considering, don't you think?
Yes. I mean, at what point do you get it? The answer is
early in 2033.
2033, of course.
Yeah, I think that's
they will get it. Some will get it. Some will
remnant, a meaningful remnant of Jews will finally get it. For most, being devoid of light will simply mean that their souls will fade away. But for some, their souls will be exiled, banished to a place without light. That's called Sheol. This dismal fate has befallen Yehudim because of the failure among Jews to observe Yahweh's Torah, preferring instead to submit to rabbinical arguments. It's one of the great lies of Judaism. I mean, one of the great lies of Judaism, of course, is that that they are somehow serving and worshiping God, which they call G-D or Hashem, never by the name that he revealed 7,000 times in his Torah, prophets, and Psalms. But the other is that religious Jews will scream that they are Torah observant. They will even refer to their Talmud as Torah, when in fact they aren't the least bit Torah observant. They're Talmud observant. Talmud is whitewashing and plastering over the Torah. It's one of the things that causes God to be most angry with his people. It's why God blinded them for so many years. Why God specifically said, I'm blocking the path. I'm going to keep them out of heaven. I'm going to keep them from even knowing the way to heaven.
Can you trust you with
that,
the truth?
That everything the Jews have touched related to Yahweh, they have corrupted and sullied. So God didn't want them to corrupt and sully his name or the path to him or his prophetic witness. So he says, I'm just going to blind you to it. You are going to be as Rabbi Samson is, arrogant and stupid, but you will be condemning yourselves, not me. That's, of course, if you want to believe God. As a result, the chosen people have suffered a power outage. They have groped in the dark because they have walked away from the light. Since the time that this was proclaimed, Yisrael and Yehudim have been shrouded in darkness. It's been a long time. Now, this obscuring gloom would remain for a millennia, mostly due to the collective and personal stubbornness of God's people. Their sense of superiority has made the best and the brightest resistant to advice, even when it comes from God. As a result, Israelites will find themselves treated cruelly, often afflicted, sometimes starving, unable to accept responsibility for their decline in status and for having been uprooted. The world still mocks them, slandering and insulting their reputation as the chosen people. Israel has remained a source of antagonism, shrouded in a fog of oppressive religious regimes. Over 100 generations of Israelites have come to live as outcasts, expelled from their land and estranged from their God, all too often bearing the brunt of hideous conspiracies. And make no mistake, they have done this to themselves. They chose this fate. They abandoned God, giving him no choice but to disinherit them. Now, that is not to say that he has replaced them with anyone else. He has not. It's not to say that he won't ultimately reconcile his relationship with them. He will. But for over 100 generations, there hasn't been a single Jew who has proclaimed Yahweh's name, shared his Torah teachings, or engaged in a covenant relationship with him. Not until quite recently, only beginning about 20 years ago. Well, Kirk, this is the conclusion of Yeshaya 8.
Mm-hmm.
It's comprised of words which lead to an understanding of the most misappropriated prophecy in the entire text of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, Isaiah 9, 6, and 7. It is addressing events that will transpire prior to God's return with his son. And since Dod is the only Melech who would be associated with Yahweh in this way, since he is the king of Yisrael at the time that this prophecy is addressing, we have been afforded a rather critical insight as to who God is addressing. Now, keep in mind, too, this is the end of chapter 8, says who? Says the religious establishments. I think it was originally a guy riding on his horse that came up with this notion of
France,
putting numbers on it. Now, I see one benefit of it. It makes it a lot easier for me to look up the Hebrew text. It makes it easier for me to convey to you, listeners, and in the books to readers, what it is that we're talking about. We put a nice index up, and you can say, I think that word is, or that concept is presented in such a, we call it a Torah address, and you can go right to it. So there are some advantages. The great disadvantage is there is this mistaken belief that you can take a chapter out of context and understand that chapter, but you can't. Too much of the meaning is lost without that context. Or they even worse, that you can take a verse, which is defined by one of these chapter and sentence numbers, and you could take it out of context, cite some or all of it, and that is sufficient. Well, that's the way that Paul went about creating Christianity, taking statements out of context and twisting them to his satisfaction, misappropriating them. So just because we're at the end of what we call the eighth chapter, understand in the original text, there was no demarcation for what was said here in what we now call Isaiah 8:22 and 9:1. One paragraph ended and the next began. The context of God's unrelenting admonition against conspiracies was one of the themes of this particular chapter. And what follows is particularly insightful in that regard. And that is because the most debilitating became the most popular. The single most popular conspiracy today isn't actually blame the Jews, although that is a subset of it. Replacement theology.
Yes.
This conspiracy that God got mad at Jews because they killed him. And that because they killed him, they were no longer deserving of a special relationship being the chosen people. And so all of the promises that he had made to them would now be transferred to a Gentile church, of which there is no mention and only adverse commentary as it relates to the ethnicity. Now, that's a pretty harebrained idea, replacement.
Yeah, I hate religion, so I'm going to give it to a religion. All the promises to a religion.
That's part of it. And, of course, the issue with that is it makes God a liar.
Yes.
It suggests that Christians are right, that Jews killed God. That's not much of a god.
Chabuk.
And of course, if that's right. Chabuk says, "Come on, God, they can't kill you.
You can't kill you."
Yeah. And if Jews, actually killed this make-believe God, wouldn't you be worshiping the Jews?
They're pretty good.
But
yeah.
But beyond all of that, the God projected his nefesh soul into Yosha for a singular purpose, to serve as the Pesach El. The Pesach El has a singular responsibility, to die, to to nourish and benefit the those celebrating Pesach. The Jews were supposed to kill the Pesach ale. It can't become the Passover lamb unless it's prepared for consumption. You don't eat it alive. And so if they are to be blamed for what the Roman Catholic Church accuses them of, we should be thankful.
Yeah.
Because the Passover lamb is only valuable when its life is taken as a substitute for our own.
Yeah.
So none of that is true. But then you get beyond that part of it to the idea that there are countless. I mean, there are thousands upon thousands of prophecies addressing the last of days, when Yahweh is returning to reconcile his relationship with Yisrael and Yehudah, where all of the prophecies pertain to God's interaction with Yisrael and Yehudah. If, in fact, the Christian church replaced Yisrael, then why didn't God say so? Is God's prophecies negated, making him a false prophet because he didn't recognize that, Jews were going to kill him, therefore he was going to have to write them out of his story and write Jews or Gentiles in, but he forgot to tell us that when he was revealing future events, so that all of his future prophecies are wrong? Or is there a secret code in there that every time it says Dode, God didn't know the name of that other guy, Jesus, and so since he never wrote Jesus anywhere, that when he wrote Dode, he really meant to say Jesus? Or God that big a dunderhead? Why is there no reference to anything that could even approximate Christian to be found? And all of those prophetic texts, if that's supposed to be the big deal of prophecy, not once, ever, anything even remotely close to it. Why isn't there a mention of Jesus? Why isn't there a single prophecy that names Jesus? Not one. Why is there no description of a church replacing the covenant? Why is there no indication that Goyim, Gentiles, are going to replace Jews, if that's such an important event? If there's going to be a religion based on replacement theology, you think God might have predicted it?
Yes, but he
and
didn't.
And so if you are a religious Jew, why aren't you able to defend God's position against the myth of the religion that has tortured you for 2,000 years? Are you that unaware of God's position? The answer appears to be yes. So replacement theology, which essentially means take everything away from Jews and give it to the Gentile church. This is the reason for the upcoming prophecy. It's the reason the prophecy in Yeshaya 9, 6, and 7 exists. It tells us it should not have been mistranslated and misappropriated, claiming for the Christian Jesus, which Yahweh had clearly conveyed about Dode. How is it that there could be a Christian New Testament that claims to replace the Torah, to obsolete the Torah, when Yahweh returns, according to his prophet Jeremiah, that the first thing he's going to do is put his Torah inside of us?
Oops.
How can there be, as there is in the Christian New Testament, a Lord, Jesus Christ, when Yahweh says through Hosea, when he returns, the one thing that he will absolutely forbid is the mention of that title, the Lord, ever again? Oops.
Mm-hmm.
Not only is Christianity the most pervasive anti-Semitic conspiracy in world history. The overwhelming preponderance of those prone to believe conspiracies are critical of Jews. And to a very, very significant extent. The very root of this is found in the corruption of Yeshayah 9. As we turn the page in our current Bibles, Tanakh, and enter the 9th chapter of Yeshayah, we discover that there is no excuse for the religious, political, militant, and conspiratorial darkness that has engulfed Israel. All the while, Jews have had their fingertips at the means to access Yah's light. Indeed, truthfully, and nevertheless key, there has been no lack of counsel. There's been no reason for discouragement. There should have been no inability to flee the darkness. Lo muaf lahi. There has been no reason for doom and gloom, for despair or dejection, because there has been no shortage of advice and wisdom on how to take flight. For those subjugated and constrained along the way. La Asher Mushtaq. For those restricted and oppressed, for those deprived of liberty, who have endured hardships during distressing times as a result of this relationship, as there was during the previous time when he receded from the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. In this later time, during the last days, he will deal harshly with the troublesome nature of the way of the sea beyond the Yarden, which means to go down, of Galil, the circuitous and convoluted way of the Goyim Gentiles. Okay, that's 9-1. I'm going to read it without all of the amplification because it's hard to follow it with that much insight, and then we'll talk about this because there's lots of insights to be gleaned from it. Indeed, there has been no lack of counsel, no reason for discouragement, nor inability to flee from the darkness, for those subjugated and constrained along the way, as there was in the previous time when he receded from the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. In this latter time, during the last days, he will deal harshly with the troublesome nature of the way of the sea beyond the Yarden, to go down, of Galil, the circuitous and convoluted way of the Goyim Gentiles. But just the end of this, if you read 9, 6, and 7 in context, it can't be speaking of the founder of a Gentile religion. Because God is saying, I'm going to deal harshly with the Goyim.
Yeah, you can't have it both ways.
I mean, so you just can't have it that way. That's the reason they take it out of context. God's not saying, hey, I'm going to start a new religion with the Goyim, and I'm going to deal harshly with the Jews. The introduction to the chapter undermines the premise of the Christian misappropriation. Okay, more to it than this. What God is saying is, listen, there was a time when he responded to two of the 12 tribes, Zebulun and Naphtali. He says, but you don't have that excuse. There is ample counsel. There's conspicuous revelation. There is no reason for you to be in the darkness. Why?
It's the Torah.
Look at the internet. The Torah, prophets, and Psalms are everywhere. There are Hebrew-English dictionaries for those who speak the most prevalent language in the world, the language spoken by Jews than any other, English. You can do what we have done.
Mm-hmm.
Or, barring that, you can read what we have done. These books sit on a bookshelf called Yada Yah, to know Yahweh. They're all available to you free. We even use Tinkerbell, Twitter, to make you aware of this message from God to you.
Yes.
We have done 10,000 hours of radio broadcasts to bring his truth to you, to call you home. You can look on, go to David's God. It's a play on words of the webmaster of Yada Yah. Site, the second link on the community, which you can click off of on the header on the Yada Yah site, yadayah.com. And you can go to the far right, and there's an index of the Torah and Prophets and Psalms that we have quoted. And you can go to anything that God says that we have quoted. And I want to tell you, click on it, and it just goes on and on and on.
Yes,
we have
does.
Taken the time to translate Yahweh's message in such a way that it communicates clearly, accurately, and powerfully to you, and then have shared the insights that we can glean from it. There is no reason for you to live in the darkness today. Yes, Jews have been subjugated, but they've been subjugated and they have been oppressed because of the likes of Rabbi Akiva and taunting Rome with a false Messiah. Now, there was a time where the truth was not ubiquitous. It was written in the Torah. It was available in the prophets and the Psalms, but those scrolls were not widely distributed. And so it was, if the leaders were corrupt, the people would have a difficult time finding the truth. That's why God is so opposed to human governance. And then the people are under a religious umbrella. They're going to be misled. Because it's different now. You have access to the truth. You have no excuse. And then just in case, Yahweh recognized that the most popular conspiracy of all time, replacement theology within the Roman Catholic Church becoming Christianity, would pretend that this prophecy that is forthcoming took place 2,000 years ago, in 33 CE. You say, no. This is about the last days. This is about you today. I want you to know this because this will help you come to know who I am, what I'm offering, and what I'm expecting in return. And it's important for you to know that this whole myth of replacement theology and therefore Christianity and to a lesser degree Islam is a pile of patooey. That God says, I am going to be against the way of the sea beyond the Jordan in opposition to the Gentiles.
Mm-hmm.
The way of the sea seems like just a throwaway line.
No.
But it actually isn't for two reasons. One is the sea here is being explained as representing Goyim. The land is... represents as a metaphor for Israelites. The sea is a metaphor for Goyim. So every time we see a reference to the sea, we can understand it based on this context. So that's kind of a nice insight.
Mm-hmm.
The second is that when I was translating Hosha several days ago, before my wife walked out on me, I was
poor thing. Poor thing.
She's going to lie. Well, actually, it's true. She did watch. She's a literalist. She's really into that. That is an accurate statement. She walked out on me three times in one morning.
But she came back.
You're
going to
read rabbinical garbage. You better at least make certain that I've had my breakfast.
And coffee twice.
You only read a small amount at a time. Can't take this anymore. Anyway, I'm just having fun. You know, this stuff. If you don't have a sense of humor, you just can't do this because it's not
funny. No, it's
okay.
Like,
so I was reading about the day of Jezreel, and it was speaking of the in the last days. This is the time where Israel has one great opportunity to come back to Yahweh. It's exactly what he's talking about here. You, Yehudim, Jews, living in these last days, have no excuse. It's the truth is available to you. And God is speaking of this day of Jezreel. And I was thinking, you know, we have always been told that Armageddon is the last battle. But I started reading everything about the last battles, and I said, wait a minute. The last battles are fought in Jerusalem. You might say it's the Valley of Jehoshaphat because his troops were there defending Jerusalem. Everything is about Jerusalem in the end. And Jezreel happens to be the location of Megiddo. Armageddon is the hill of Megiddo. That is a battle that transpires in a different place. And year could be, I don't know, you know, it doesn't tell us that if it's a day before or years before, but it's more than a day, is because Israel uses the ruins and the what's left behind of the Islamic, the Magog Federation. This is Gog and Magog presented in Ezekiel. God uses, or the people of Israel use what they have left behind for a number of months. And so it has to precede the final battle by a considerable period of time. And so Armageddon is not the last battle. And so that was interesting. But one of the things that was, because I was trying to find out where these things were taking place, and the battle in Jezreel, which is particularly around Megiddo, where Yahweh is going to personally assassinate Gog and his Magog Federation, wipe them out, incinerate them. It talks about the way of the sea. Well, the Jezreel Valley is the way of the sea. And so it's a way of referencing the Jezreel Valley. But it's important here to say that the way of the sea is associated with Gentiles. The Magog War is the worst of the Gentiles. It's Muslims that are coming to attack Israel. And the way that they are described, which I think is also described in Yeshaya 18, is that they flood into Israel. It's a great deluge of them, probably in the range of 100 million. I just, for giggles, I said, okay, so what's the square? How many square miles is the Jezreel Valley? Just shy of 100 square miles is the answer. I looked up, you know, how much does the average combatant take to be properly equipped and supplied, where they're on the march or bivouacked in an encampment? It's about three square yards. And so I did the math, and it just so happens to come out that exactly 100 million people will fit into the Jezreel Valley.
Very good.
Nonetheless,
good.
It's an interesting read.
I don't
so
care.
In,
cool.
In this statement, we have lots of insights, and we are within 15 seconds of no longer broadcasting. We're going to continue to report.
Okay.
So
okay.
We'll go ahead and talk a little bit more about this, and then we'll pick up at this point in our program next week.
Okay.
So, for the millions of Jews who have suffered so grievously at the hands of conspiratorial, political, and religious Gentiles these past 3,000 years. Yeah, and I go back 3,000 years because, you know, you've got the Assyrians.
Right after Solomon.
Yeah, well, actually you have the the Philistines and their modern incarnation, of course, the Palestinians. No, they're not modern incarnation, Smith. But the Philistines, you certainly have the Assyrians, you have the Babylonians, you have the Greeks, you have Imperial Rome, and then the you have the Roman Catholic Church, you have the wave of Muslims and all of their iterations, the Nazis. It's been a bad go for the last 3,000 years.
Yes.
And now
never ended.
You have the ultimate dunderheads of anti-Semites. They call themselves progressives.
In
fact, I was writing and said, you know, Yahweh is going to try to resolve the problem of those who have been religious but are no more, and who have been political but are no more, and but it's even beyond God to try to resolve the problem of progressives. A completely unused brain is not a novel idea. So Yahweh's assertion here is that his people, particularly as we move through the last 30 or 40 years, could have precluded having been agonized had they bothered to read what he had to say. Now, one of the things that you realize, and you know, I've just translated a large swath of Ezekiel. I'm now translating Hosea. I've translated most of Yeshaya, and I translated one of Moshe's most spectacular speeches in the Devarim here recently. And gosh, it is so overwhelming. The number one theme, the single most repeated theme throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms is God saying, I hate religion. In particular, I hate the religion of Jews. It is the number one and most overriding theme throughout the Torah and prophets. God despises religion in general and Judaism in particular. And to have all of that laid out for you in no uncertain terms, repeated in every possible way, told from so many different perspectives, and not get it, and still pretend that there is some divine benefit of being a religious Jew, is so hypocritical. It's so ignorant. And God said there's no excuse for it. I made this revelation to you. I wrote it in your language. I gave it to you. I liberated you from religion. I begged you not to be religious. And yet you ignored all of that and became ever more stiff-necked and religious. So Yahweh was saying, you could have precluded all of this. But they didn't, because his people's response has always been to justify their corruptions of God's testimony. They will go to their grave saying that there was an oral Torah delivered to the elders at the time of the written Torah. And of course, not only does God make it clear that there's only one Torah and it was in writing, and that there was no other Torah or other oral instruction given, saying exactly the opposite of what they have said, that the myth that there was such a thing is as foolish, as irresponsible as replacement theology. In fact, it is a form of replacement theology.
Yeah. Absolutely it is, yeah.
So based upon his people's response, there has never been any justification for God to intervene, to protect or heal anyone here on earth. And while that is counter to most every religious notion, it is as it should be. There would be no reason for God to intervene on behalf of those who do not know him and who haven't listened to him. Doing so would undermine everything that he has said and done. Heck, if he walked into Auschwitz and unlocked the door, they would build a shrine to the next version of the golden calf. They would venerate some rabbi who was incarcerated in there with them, or who just died in the flames. They'd find a way to give credit to the God that they had made in their image. Moreover, Yahweh has already provided all of the advice and counsel that we would ever need to live free and fulfilling lives. As long as we know where to look and whom to trust, the life light that illuminates the path home shines brightly. And we've been doing this now, Kirk. I've been doing it for 21 years. On average, probably 10 hours a day, 6 days, 7 days a week for 21 years. And the truth be known, I've probably translated less than a quarter of what there is to learn from Yahweh. And I'm really hoping that I finish these last three volumes in the rewrites, and that I can turn to what I really think I need to be addressing is, what about those last two battles? God says a lot about them. And he wants us to understand what he's saying. And he says it won't be understood until the very last days. But so can you bring the witness of Daniel, chapter 9 as it leads into 10, 11, and 12? Can you bring the last chapters of Daniel together with the concluding chapters of Zechariah, with Yeshayah from about chapter 40 through the end of the book, 60-something, with what's said about the fall of Babylon and Yirmiyah, with Yahkatzel starting at about chapter 38 going through 42, 43.
Mm-hmm.
Can you bring all of that together and come up with a who is doing what's to whom, where and why, and such that God's people are prepared for what's going to occur? There's clearly two battles.
Yes.
They are distanced from one another by enough time that Yisrael got complacent again after God's victory over the marauding flood of jihadists in the Magog War. They are attacked and saved again, this time in Jerusalem. And so that's probably got to be in the next book. But, you know, my best guess is that it's over a year's worth of translating. It's probably three volumes just to cover what God has to say to battle.
Well,
that's a lot of prophetic ink.
You're not kidding.
And, of course, the challenge will be to eliminate from our minds everything that we have been told in Revelation.
Oh, yeah.
And derive the insights exclusively from Yahkatzel, Yirmiyah, Yeshayah, Zechariah, and Daniel. Yoel has a lot to say about the last battle. So all of that has to be connected and interpreted, understood, correctly translated, so we can find out why God said so much about two battles. You know, his people he does have a lot to say about the battles against the Assyrians and why they took place, the battles against the Babylonians and why they took place, the battles against the Greeks and Romans. and then the Roman Catholic Church, and of course Muslims. But this is special.
Mm-hmm.
And what religious Jews have done is just throw up their arms and say it's all mysterious and it's symbolic language and it might be a spiritual battle. It might have already happened. It may be talking about a physical battle, but nobody knows. But God didn't write it for nobody to know.
No.
And so, you know, I've got probably to the end of this year continuing to edit the whole series of Yada Yah, and I may then work to... with Jackie and others to get Tea with Terrorists and The Company and Prophet of Doom into the Amazon Books collection and onto the shelf, because exposing and condemning Islam is important, but also coming to an understand group and corporate dynamics is important. If you don't understand economics in particular, it's going to be very difficult to understand. What's
apparently nobody
transpire.
Does anymore. So
yeah, so in the company is useful for that. This is a project that we will be undertaking in really throughout 2023. And I hope to end up with two or three volumes that allows Yahweh to express why he shares so much about what's going to transpire to his people. He does not want them blindsided. He wants them to know what's going to occur so that they can prepare themselves and flee the religious, flee the political, and rely on him. Because if you rely on him, all good things happen. You become immortal. You are perfected. You are adopted, enriched, and empowered, forever becoming part of the covenant. You know, it was interesting that the last last statement that I was translated today was the conclusion of Hosea chapter 2. And, you know, what it says is pretty famous. It says that, you know, when Yahweh returns on the, and the reference is to, it doesn't state it specifically, but the reference is to that specific day, which is the day of reconciliations, Yom Kippur.
Yeah, Yom Kippur.
He says that that at that moment his people are going to welcome him as an ish, an individual. And that means we're not welcoming Yahweh and relating to Yahweh as God, but as an ish.
No,
an
it's a person. Yeah, it's a person.
Which is
individual,
how,
yeah.
By the way, Abraham related to Yahweh. He was as an ish.
Yes. Yeah.
That's how he met with Shamuel, as an ish, an individual.
Well, Abraham,
it's a powerful concept, this ish individual. But what it necessitates is that God's going to have to empower us, enrich us, elevate us, to the point where the differences between us as flawed mortal beings in 3D to spiritual beings essentially like light as 7D infused with his Torah written inside of us is that we're going to be so much similar to God that we're going to relate to God as an individual.
Well, boring that, I don't
powerful.
Think we could relate to.
A pretty powerful concept. That means that we're going to be elevated considerably for that to happen. And then the second part of it is, God says, the single most important thing I want to tell you about, this is the most important day in my entire existence, the day of reconciliation, your 6,000 Yah, is that I will never, ever, for the rest of time, ever have to hear that title and name, the Lord, ever again.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, the most common name for God in religion, whether it be Islam or Judaism or Christianity, is the Lord. And God says, that will be the N-word of the future of evermore. The first official act of forever is... Elimination
of that, yeah.
The title and
the L word,
the Lord. That should get your attention. So anyway, it's always fun to translate Yah's testimony. We learned so much. You know, I want to make certain that those who are listening to this program who are Yehudim, they feel welcome. Yes, we do criticize Judaism because you can't study and share Yahweh's testimony without criticizing Judaism. It's the God uses it as the greatest blight against his people. So it's important for you to know that God is anti-religious and particularly anti-rabbi and anti-Judaism. And he is opposed to those things because he loves his people and he wants to restore his relationship with him. And that isn't possible while they cling to the rabbinical rubbish. So we're not in a position that the rabbis have ever faced before, because any time they have been criticized in the past, it's somebody trying to evangelize them and encourage them to some other religion, whether it convert to Islam over with a sword over their head or convert to Christianity. And no, we are equal opportunity haters when it comes to those religions. I mean, I don't think there's anyone who has attempted to translate Yahweh's testimony and, you know, in over 20 volumes, who has also written a comprehensive expose against the religion of Islam, as I have with Prophet of Doom, and also four-volume set exposing and condemning Christianity. So, you know, we are, as is God, equal opportunity
religion
when it comes to religion.
Yeah.
And if you don't understand that God is anti-religious, then there's no chance that you'll be part of the covenant, because walking away from one's country, from
religion.
Babel, and from the religiosity of one's nation is the first requirement of the covenant. And Israel, it's really impossible to disassociate politics and religion. Should Likud come back into power, they will be inseparable again. So that's our program for tonight. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being part of it, Kirk. We look forward to being with you, this time next week. We may pick up again at 9:01, but we'll move on from there as we continue to study the Word of Almighty God. Good night.
Thank you. Good night. Shalom.